welcome to the first episode of Behind the Masthead, a special series of the Behind the Evidence podcast, supported by the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. My name is Casey Calver. I'm editorial director at the Graykin Center, where I work on our two publications, Alcohol, Other Drugs, and Health Current Evidence, which summarizes the latest clinically relevant substance use research, and a peer-reviewed journal published by Springer Nature BMC called Addiction Science and Clinical Practice. Usually, I'm behind the scenes as the editor of Behind the Evidence, but for this series, I'm sharing the mic with Honora and Mark. Over the next four episodes or so, we're going to be talking with addiction journal editors, publishers, and other scholars about the most pressing challenges to addiction research and publishing in this moment, amid rapid shifts in the federal policies and funding priorities that shape the trajectories of substance use research in the U.S. and across the globe. In this first episode, I invited two of the editors of Addiction Science and Clinical Practice, Emily Williams and Alex Wally, to share their insights on this moment. We covered a lot of ground, from the lessons we can learn from the resilience of people who use drugs to changes to the NIH's public access policy. So I think there's something in here for all of our listeners. Check the show notes to learn more about the Graykin Center and our publications. Please also consider submitting anonymous questions or comments to be considered for inclusion in future episodes in this series. Lastly, a request, consider leaving a review of this podcast on your platform of choice. It really helps us to reach new listeners. Now, on to the interview. Everyone, today is August 20th, 2025, and I'm pleased to be here with two of my colleagues on the journal Addiction Science and Clinical Practice, Drs. Emily Williams and Alexander Wally. For our listeners who may not know you, can you please introduce yourselves and tell us where you work and what kind of research you do?
Sure. I'm Emily Williams. I work at the University of Washington. I'm a professor of health systems and population health in the School of Public Health at the University of Washington, and I have affiliate appointments at the VA, Puget Sound Health Services Research and Development Center of Innovation, as well as Kaiser Permanente Washington Health Research Institute. I'm an addictions health services researcher and implementation scientist. I also have a wide disparities portfolio and focus on the intersection of HIV and unhealthy substance use. I also am really focused on getting evidence-based care to where patients are. That includes community-based settings where people are receiving naloxone. That includes HIV clinics. That includes primary care, hospital-based settings. Sort of wherever we can find patients, we would love to get them the care that they need for their addictions, which affect more than 60 medical conditions.
My name's Alex Wally. I am a general internist and HIV primary care physician and also an addiction medicine specialist at the Boston Medical Center. I also am a professor of medicine at the BU or Boston University School of Medicine. Some of my other roles include working for our state health department, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. I'm the medical director at the Bureau of Substance Addiction Services. And there I take a big interest in community naloxone access and community harm reduction and access to evidence-based treatments for substance use disorders. I was a fellowship director for our addiction medicine fellowship for a long time. So I have a big interest in educating the next generation of clinical leaders in substance use care. My research is really focused on overdose and trying to integrate high quality substance use care into general medical settings like the inpatient hospital or into primary care. And I am an associate editor for Addiction Science and Clinical Practice. And in 2026, my longtime mentor is transitioning from being co-editor-in-chief with Emily to being our editor emeritus. And I have the good fortune to step into his shoes, although they'll be very large, and be co-editor-in-chief along with Emily. So very excited to be here today and talk to you too about this topic.
Thanks, Alex. And of course, you're talking about Jeffrey Sammet, who's the current co-editor-in-chief of ASCP. Emily, I think we already know this, but you want to tell us what your role is on a journal?
Yes, I am with our shared mentor, Jeffrey Sammet, the co-editor-in-chief of Addiction Science Clinical and Practice, and I have been since 2021, but I've been with the journal as an associate editor since its inception as a open access journal in 2011. So I have a long history with ASCP, and I'm happy to be here to talk about it today.
So am I. I'm really happy that you're both here to talk to us. And I guess, Emily, I'd like to hear a little bit more about, we know when, right, you became an addiction journal editor, but do you want to tell us why you went down that road?
Yeah. Well, I think similar to Alex, I also deeply care about training the next generation of researchers and people in this field. And I think we both might have learned that from our shared mentors. So at the time in 2011, I was being mentored by Rich Sates and Jeffrey Sammet. Rich Sates has now passed, but is also an editor emeritus of the journal. And they offered me this opportunity. I had worked with Rich on my dissertation. I had worked with Jeffrey on some consulting work after I had gotten my master's degree in public health and while I was doing my PhD in health services. And being offered the opportunity from these mentors who I trusted felt like this is a great opportunity for growth, and it felt like a real opportunity for learning that they trusted me with. And so that's really how I got into it.
How about you, Alex?
Well, I've been writing, authoring journal articles for a while. So that's, I think my first article was maybe 1999. Like, but then, you know, I didn't really understand or get into research until, you know, maybe 8 or 9 years later. 2007, 2008 is when I did a research fellowship and started both writing and then becoming a reviewer. So I had gotten pretty strong advice from my mentors that being a journal reviewer is a great way to learn about the publishing process from, you know, the inside, but also to contribute to peer-reviewed science. And so that has been a rewarding experience. I put off opportunities to become an associate editor for a while. I worked on this companion publication called aodhealth.org, which Casey also is the managing editor of. And I found that very rewarding. That was summarizing articles. And so that was an editor role, but not quite what a journal editor does. But I jumped at the chance to be an associate editor at Addiction Science Clinical Practice. And it's been a great experience. So that was about 3 years ago, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. And so I've been involved and really enjoyed it, and look forward to continuing to do it.
Emily, do you want to tell us, you know, how being an addiction journal editor has affected the rest of your work or your publishing activity?
Yeah, I mean, I think like Alex is saying, you can learn a ton from reading the work that is in development. You can learn not only about the content of the work that you're interested in, but you can learn about the skill of communicating that work. And I think it has taught me a lot about optimal methods of communication of our work. I think it's also been really helpful as an editor to learn how to respond to editors or reviewers, because I can see what is easy for us to take in and helps us have all the information in front of us that we might need in order to make a sound decision. And I translate that into my own work. I also think it makes me much more aware of the breadth of work that's going on in the world. And I love that about it. It diversifies my mind about content and work that's happening in the world. ASCP is an international journal. We are still working on getting more submissions and a greater number of publications from places outside of the US. But we do have them, and we receive a fair number of submissions. And it's really great to be able to just sort of see the breadth of what's happening out there. It can inform not only the work that we're all doing and thinking about, but also just our perspectives. I mean, in all of my life, I'm always looking for ways to expand my perspective and understand there are more than one ways of doing things, more than my way of doing things. And I think like being an editor really helps add to that perspective for me.
I work in a setting where there's actually quite a few of us who are interested in addiction, who are physicians, who are in other disciplines like nursing or social work or case management or counseling. And in my day in, day out experience, I'm privileged to be around other people who are interested in addiction care. But we form our own bubble locally here, and we don't have all the answers at all. We generate a lot of questions. We try to generate some solutions and study them. But just echoing Emily's point about, understanding the breadth of the community of people who are interested in advancing the care and science and practice of addictions is really something you get a great view of from where we sit as editors. The global perspective, I think also the national perspective, we have a great group of associate editors. And when we meet, many of them are people who I've read their work. And now I get to, talk to them about papers that we're considering. And then, that builds my network. And then that international perspective, I think, is also really kind of important. Nobody really that I'm aware of gets into addiction research without being very compassionate and committed. So while we're diverse, there's this group of shared values, a commitment to science and to patient care that is broadly distributed. And so it's through editing at the journal that I feel some connection to this. It's eye-opening.
Thank you so much. I kind of want to dig into why we're here today. And maybe, Emily, we can start with your thoughts on some of the most pressing challenges and threats that you see in addiction publishing in this moment in August 2025.
It's been a hard time in the last year. Federal research is under siege. And sort of consistently being reorganized and confusing in new ways in the United States. And I think it would be not too much to say that freedom of speech is being compromised in some ways as a result of new executive orders and administrative policies at the federal level. So I think that's a huge challenge to academia, to research generally in the United States. We're not the first country to have dealt with dictator-like practices around public goods, which historically research has been. And so I don't want to, put forward any exceptionalism on that front. But I do think, given that a majority of addiction literature and research in this day and age does come from and or is published from the United States, that we are in a time of unprecedented challenges editorially. I think there's challenges on the researcher side, and I think there's researcher university side, and I think there's challenges on the population side. And, the research university researcher side, one of the huge challenges is that the fact that research is so challenging in this moment in time has made those who we have been training to be the next generation of researchers much more hesitant to use their voices and to report strongly their research and use their training to better the world. And so I think there's a lot of fear that is impacting addiction publishing in this moment. On the university side, I think there's some similar fear and fewer resources to support publishing. You know, so for instance, ASCP is an open access journal. I think we'll get into more open access policies. But as more and more of this public good, as the onus of providing this public good is put more and more on universities and individuals, I think it will get harder and harder for us to disseminate information. And then our populations, I think, with specific to addictions research, you know, addictions disproportionately impact persons of color, persons with low economic resources, persons living in neighborhoods that have fewer resources than others, people with HIV, people with chronic liver disease. And there's obviously some chicken egg related things there. But nonetheless, people who generally have harder lives and fewer resources than some of the rest of us. And I think that those populations are under siege too. I think work that has been directed to supporting those populations has been broadly put under it, and an envelope of EDI, equity, diversity, and losing a word right
inclusion.
Now. Inclusion. Thank you. And while I firmly stand behind the full idea of EDI, I also feel like regardless of whether we're going to take away a sort of big construct that is EDI, we're harming people if we do that, if we can't focus on populations who are disproportionately affected by fewer resources. And I think that will suffer. I know I'm really speaking in a ethnocentric way with the United States, and I'm trying not to, but this is my lived experience right now. So I'm just going from that. And I think when we conduct research and then lose research funding in populations that are disproportionately affected by lack of resources and historically mistreated by research and universities and academia and other structures in the United States, I think we double down on the loss of trust that we have in those communities. And I think that makes us less and less able to study those communities. And so I think that the impacts will be seen for generations. And I think there are a lot of barriers to addiction research right now in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I was interested in something you said up in the beginning about freedom of speech. And, you know, something I know that you all have probably been part of these conversations too, is if diversity, equity, inclusion research is sort of being canceled at this moment, then I wonder, are you seeing or are you hearing anecdotally of researchers that are censoring themselves or are concerned about publishing research with that kind of terminology, with that kind of research focus? Are we seeing that?
Yeah, I have a colleague who is not putting their name on any of our papers at this moment for that reason. And I'm seeing a lot of mentees talk to me about their fears of putting their thoughts out there in the world. I'm seeing mentees who are frustrated by new NIH policies that are asking for changes in language because they feel like they are, you know, being asked to
censor themselves, really.
Censor themselves.
Yeah.
When it comes to substance use in the United States and I think in other countries, but there's a long legacy of stigmatization and criminalization, and this has intersected with other culturally structured modes of discrimination, like specifically racism and the war on drugs and mass incarceration. And so that's our history. That came well before the current administration. So these efforts at trying to oppress people are not new. And, you know, despite that, I think a lot of us that are doing addiction research, we're motivated to come into this field because of because of the progress that has been made and the opportunity to really make a difference. So for me, and I think again for a lot of us, but I'll talk about myself, like I chose to go to medical school at a time when HIV as a medical illness was converted from being a terminal illness to a chronic disease, which was a very good thing. And the reason that happened was because new medications were invented by science, but that science was pushed very hard by activism. And then the realization of the promise of that advance in medical care required social movements to really destigmatize the culture and change it. And we have had similar forces in substance use that have occurred since then, both the efforts to destigmatize people who use substances, the care that they receive, the people who provide that care, their families, but then this countervailing force that continuing to try to keep those stigmatizing pieces of the culture in place. You can't be a person who uses substances and live for very long if you don't have resilience. And so those of us who have the privilege of working with them or doing research with them, we also like get a piece of that resilience over time, right? And so that is like, I think, a big piece of this. We're not going to be deterred by a little headwind or some challenge, but things are different now in that the challenges are explicit. They're, you know, there is self-censoring, which is a huge issue, but there is like literal censoring now. Right. Harm reduction was a dirty word like for a long time, and we all self-censored in our grant applications. But the science of harm reduction moved along. And then it's been a lot easier, but, you know, there's still been challenges. Now, you know, there's this battle over the language, which is really, it's become explicit. In some ways, you could argue you appreciate that, like the fact that, you know, we know what we're up against. It's not as, I wish it were not so hidden, but the hidden part, I think, is still also there. And in the end, when Emily said we're going to be set, I don't know if you said we're going to be set back decades or it's going to take decades to that I hope not. You know, I hope that we're going to be able to right the ship on a sooner timeline. But at least the part that like allows us to, you know, use the words that accurately describe what's going on. So yeah, this is a huge challenge, and it's about you know, current researchers. It's also and care providers, but it's also really about the future. Like these, while we've made progress, there's so much more to do, and things change so rapidly in our field. Just the drug supply itself, like
right,
it's dynamic, and that makes it exciting area. But also really necessary. But you're essentially going to, as there are in lots of other areas of science, a giant chilling effect. And yeah, you know, many people who do this work have other choices. And so when these pressures are exerted, some of them are going to choose other things to do. And that's going to really, that will set us back. It'll be a lost opportunity, hopefully not a whole lost generation.
I will take your optimism in the place of my anxiety. Thank you. but I do, I guess I think part of where I'm coming from on that is like, you know, racism also used to be a bad word. We used to not be able to say that. We used to, you know, we used to write from the place of the individual, like people you know, who are Black have these health issues, when actually, like, what we're talking about are, you know, decades and centuries of structures that have limited the opportunities of people to optimize their health. And now, again, we have to not say those things. And I think, like, I guess that for me is what feels like it's untraining us. I mean, I literally just edited some aims yesterday of a grant where I was like, I'm returning to the kind of writing I did 5 years ago before we started learning about how to talk about this in a way that was more fair to the truth. And so I guess those are the places my worries come from. Like, not only, you know, does that mean we're breaking trust with communities by going back to individual level blame, but we're also unlearning some skills that really helped move the field along.
Well, and when you think about how it's really the accumulation over time of knowledge and findings, and you build on those and you take new ideas from your previous studies, and we know very well that research follows funding, right? Like, you're not going to do research that you can't support through usually federal dollars. So I'm just imagining over time, these accumulated gaps or these accumulated roads not taken, right? And that lost opportunity, that lost body of knowledge that's going to be either set back or just delayed and
right.
Damage.
And a key example of that is with sexual and gender minority research. Like, in addictions, both drug use and unhealthy alcohol use are higher, more prevalent and more consequential in communities that identify as sexual minoritized populations or transgender populations. The rate of suicide in transgender patients is huge, and the association between substance use and suicide is very strong. And, you know, the complete federal defunding of all research related to sexual and gender minoritized populations is going to fall in that category that you're talking about, Casey. Like, it will set us back, and it is a betrayal of those communities.
I also feel like it's been a bit of a slow process. I think, I don't know what your experiences have been, but going to meetings this spring, it was a little bit like business as usual. Of course, everybody's worried, everybody's concerned, but because the way the sort of federal funding structures work in this country, it's always been like slow, incremental change, sort of thoughtfully executed over time. And I think I have this bad feeling that we're sort of at the end of the long weekend where, like, we're about to hit, you know, the brutality of Monday morning when, you know, all of these changes actually trickle down. I don't know if you all sort of share that feeling of impending doom.
I mean, I share it. But I really loved, Alex, the perspective that you offered in terms of, you know, like people with addictions and like people with low resources, resilience is also an extremely strong characteristic. And we do show that in our community of researchers as well. I agree with you about the meetings this summer, Casey. That was probably a highlight of my year, to be at you know, groupings of leading experts from all over the world who are remain dedicated and scrappy.
Right.
And I think it's important.
Yes. I think in addiction research, we have, there is that ethic of being scrappy, collaborative. I think that'll serve well over time. I would never have imagined that the federal government in the US would go after universities in these like transactional manner just to extract a payment for no reason. Like, these aren't payments of budgetary consequence to the federal government. They're just trying to make a point to punish. And there have been, I think, not addiction journals specifically, but peer-reviewed journals in general have been mentioned as potential targets for this type of mean, cruel retribution for I don't know what crimes. And so, like, that's either going to happen or it's not going to happen. I don't, I don't think we know. It could happen. I never thought it would. Like, I never thought what has happened to universities would have happened, and that's happening. So it could happen. But I actually don't believe that we can do anything to prevent it from happening. I think the point is the punishment and the cruelty. It's not really about what the people who are being targeted or the institutions that are being targeted are actually doing. And, you know, if you look at the case of the universities, you know, there's a lot of excuses, you know, that they're sort of punishing for one thing when the issues are, again, really not about what the universities have done or not done. So I'm not sure there's anything. Yeah, again, I'm a little relatively new to this editing game, but I don't really think there's a lot we can do to protect ourselves from that. And therefore, I think all the more reason that we need to continue to stay true to the principles of seeking truth and good science and peer review. I didn't sign it, but the editorial that Emily was part of, I think that was a really inspiring example of how it's important to take a stand. And I, you know, I think a lot of people may feel that was courageous and maybe risky, but I do think it's the right thing to do. And I don't think not doing it protects us. You know, I think it's saying nothing that is really going to be the most problematic.
Let's talk about the editorial. So there was an editorial published in Nordic Studies on Alcohol and Drugs, and it was signed by 29 addiction journal editors from 12 countries, and sort of issuing a clarion call, as they say, to the addiction science community to reverse the unethical, illegal, and unscientific activities that, you know, we're talking about here. So, Emily, I know you signed it. Do you want to talk about the decision-making that went into signing it and what you kind of think about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to use our voices. We do still have freedom of speech in this moment, and we have a lot of training and expertise. And I see myself as, I mean, when I'm talking about the world of people with and without resources, I see myself as someone with resources. I'm not Bill Gates or anything, but I have social capital, I have educational capital, I have employment capital, and I think that, like, the best thing we can do in this moment is use our voices when we have that kind of capital. And so for me, it felt like a no-brainer to sign it. I mean, it's not that I'm not scared of retribution, but when I think out, you know, when I think out, like, I may lose my job, I may lose my funding, and that is scary. But I also know that I have the skills and I have a big network, and that, you know, if those things happened, I would have the tools within me to move forward in my life. And that it will be more important to me to feel that I've done everything I could to protect what we've worked for.
When it hasn't been theoretical for you, right, Emily? Like, your funding has been impacted over the last 6 months.
Yeah, it has. I lost three and almost a fourth of my grants. I wasn't PI of that fourth one. But... yeah, I mean, we lost them all due to their focus on EDI. And they came back through a lawsuit. The state of Washington joined 22 other states in suing the Trump administration. The lawsuit was won, and my grants were returned. And I, you know, I think that's one form of having been impacted. I have not been personally targeted, as far as I know. And I think that would feel like a whole other level. But I still feel like the most important thing I can do is use my well-trained voice to support efforts that I know how to support.
I mean, something I think about a lot, to Alex's point about the the attack on universities. And I think among the public, there's a sort of lack of understanding of what that funding is for when, you know, the federal government gives a university a big, you know, big amount of money every year. Really, it's for the conducting of the research that you do, and others, you know, your colleagues. Is there a role, do you think, in the group of addiction journal editors or scholars in general to try to help people understand that this funding is really supporting research that has been life-saving and probably everyone we know has benefited from that kind of research?
I mean, I think there's a role for editorials that state as much that describe. I mean, I loved Alex's use case example with the HIV epidemic. It's true. Like, without advocacy, we wouldn't have had research in that area. And maybe we're at that point again here where we really need to be focusing on advocacy for research, which I think we are, and I am already doing. And I do think there's a role for addiction journal editors in this way. Like, I think one of them was, via that editorial we just talked about, the Clarion call. I've also spoken with a reporter at the New Yorker and a reporter at Higher Ed. I do think the media has a role here too, and that us, with broader understandings of the breadth of and influence of addictions research should be at the table for conversations with the media.
I reread the editorial today, and I was so proud of the fact that you all wrote it. One thought that kind of occurred to me as I was reading it was, well, first of all, I think there's 28 authors, and I think fewer than five of them were from the US. But in the editorial, and really the editorial is about what's going on in the US. But it's really from an international group of leaders in addiction research and addiction publishing. So, I'm somebody who's trying to make things better here in the US, and I spent a lot of time thinking about our deficits, the problems that we have, and oftentimes I take inspiration from other countries that have figured out better ways to deliver care. So that's my typical stance, but it struck me as I was reading that editorial that a lot of the innovation in harm reduction and in treatment started or has been supercharged in the United States. And that's partly because of the, innovation in our culture, the size of our country, but it's in a large part due to the support for research. And in the editorial, I think it's cited that, over half of the funding of the world's total research comes from the United States. So the rest of the world really does rely on our research infrastructure. And so it's an affront to the rest of the world, it's not just about us. And so, that is both something for us to be very proud of, that we have prioritized research in our country, we've prioritized science, and then it makes it all the more alarming or disconcerting that in 6 months we can go from where we were to where we are. So it's really it's we're not living on an island. What happens in the US is very important. We're not the only people in the world, but we are connected. And so, that means that it's important to continue what we're doing here, for our own sake and for the rest of the world.
Yeah, and we've been living with a value for a very, very long time that knowledge is important, that innovation is important, and that it's a public good for everybody. And that is shifting.
Yeah, it will remain to be seen how that plays out, you know, over the next few months and years. I guess I just want to know if there's anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to bring up, or anything you'd like to add before we close here.
Well, I did want to mention this thing that I actually don't think has to do with the current administration around publishing, which is a challenge that has emerged like in the midst of that, which, you know, this is a Addiction Journal Publishers podcast, so we can really nerd out on this stuff. But the NIH has this policy that articles published after July 1st that are funded by the NIH need to be immediately available in PubMed Central. Mm-hmm. And it dictates that to the authors who receive NIH funding and puts the onus on them. Mm-hmm. And many people are publishing, I don't know if most, I think probably still most addiction literature is published in journals that are subscription model journals, and their model, their financial model means that they typically embargo the access on PubMed Central or other open access for 12 months. That's the typical. And so there's a conflict now between what the NIH is expecting and what these subscription journals are expecting, and the mm-hmm. author is really caught in the middle. Now, the solution to this is to publish open access, which of course ASCP is an open access journal. Mm-hmm. But to publish open access, authors typically have to pay a publication fee, and that's in the thousands of dollars, often, you know, some $1,000 to $4,000. And so you could write that into your grant proposal, but many people haven't done that, or, you know, that leaves less money to do the research. And then it also leaves these subscription journals. Most subscription journals have, an option for people mm-hmm. to pay a fee to make it open access. So there's a lot of discussion among researchers right now. And again, we're not dealing with this directly. This could benefit ASCP in the short term. Maybe we'll get more submissions because of this. But I do think it's disconcerting for many people who are doing research of what's going to happen to the typical subscription model. I'll just say, as somebody who has published a lot of my most impactful work, if I do say myself, that has been unfunded, where we did not have a budget for in our grant or otherwise to pay publication fees, I would still need to go to a subscription journal. But the subscription journals are going to want to get the most high impact research, and that's probably going to be funded. So anyway, that's big topic that I just wanted to mention, because you know that this is what's going on in our world right now.
Yeah, and a few points on that, that I have learned that if your funding for your research ended before July 1st, 2025, then you are exempt from this new mandate, which has been good news for a lot of people who are publishing maybe secondary analyses on data for studies that have ended. You can go back to that 2013. There was a memo in 2013 that required that or allowed that 12-month embargo before your article would be released. And I'll also say, I can't speak for publishers, but certainly unfunded researchers or researchers who are publishing research that's not funded anymore can make an appeal to open access journals. I think I will always tell people and authors that you should always, always ask if there are any opportunities for a waiver, make your case. That would be my two pieces of information and advice on that one. But it's sort of added this layer of chaos on top of everything else. You know, this was supposed to be implemented at the end of the year, at the end of 2025, and it got moved up to July 1st, and everyone's been scrambling.
It is more barriers to publishing. It is more of taking a public good and putting the onus of of cost for that good on individuals and systems in an economy that is like getting harder and harder. I just, with a team at the VA, asked for an increase in the budget line for a grant in order to get the work done, and the VA denied it. And, you know, it's just getting harder and harder to get this work done with the way the budget lines are, because people are needing and making more money, and research is costing more, and research incentives should cost more. So it's challenging times.
I think you're giving me ideas for a whole other episode on the pluses and minuses and advantages and disadvantages of open access publishing. So watch out. You might be getting more invitations from me. But I really want to thank you both. It's been such a privilege to talk to you about these things and to hear your perspectives. And I'm just, as always, in awe of you as researchers and as individuals. And I'm really grateful to work with both of you. And thank you so much for being here today.
Super grateful to work with you too, Casey. Thanks for inviting us.
Always a pleasure, Casey. And Emily, I'm looking forward to this uncertain future that we have.
Together, we will work it out. Looking forward to it too, Alex.
Behind the Evidence is hosted by Honora Englander and Mark LaRochelle. Production by Raquel Silveira. Editing by Casey Calver. Music and cover art by Mary Tomanovich. Miriam Kamarami is the Executive Director of the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center and Co-Editor-in-Chief of AOD Health, together with David Filene. Learn more about AOD Health and subscribe for free at www.aodhealth.org. Behind the Evidence is supported by the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. It is intended for educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views expressed here are our own and do not necessarily reflect those of our employers or the authors of the articles we review. All patient information has been modified to protect their identities.